That binds the European Union outlines a gradual ban on Russian oil imports over its war in Ukraine. The Yemeni army says it has shot down a Saudi spy drone over the northwestern city of Hajjah. And also in our headlines, the Chinese capital shuts nearly 200 subway stations and bus routes in an attempt to keep COVID in check. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour, the European Union has unveiled plans for gradual ban on Russian oil imports as part of its sixth round of sanctions against Russia over its war in Ukraine. European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen said there would be a complete curb on all Russian oil, seaborne and pipeline crude, and refined as well. Russia's biggest bank and the head of the Russian Orthodox Church are included in the sanctions list. However, Russia's gas exports are excluded from the embargo. If approved, countries heavily dependent on Russian oil have to adapt to a new situation. Meanwhile, the German economy minister backed the measure, but warned that the ban could lead to supply disruptions and price hikes. Representatives of the 27-member bloc are set to meet to discuss the plan, which needs unanimous approval to go into effect. We've talked to our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, to get more details about the EU's new sanctions on Russia. Let's listen in.
That this is the sixth round of sanctions being proposed by the European Commission. And as you mentioned, you know, it's a proposal from the European Commission. They formulate the sanctions, and then it's up to the European Council to basically agree on it. That's the 27 member states, the EU leaders. And of course, it has to be rubber stamped finally in the European Parliament. But there are divisions, and that's because, you know, the repercussions, as you mentioned, we heard statements like, you know, the EU doesn't want to shoot itself in the foot during this debate in the European Parliament. But in terms of the sanctions itself, von der Leyen outlined more individuals will be placed on the EU sanction list, more Russian individuals, mainly involved in Russia's military. There's a proposal to take Russia's largest bank out of the SWIFT financial transfer payment system, which is a significant move from a financial perspective. A number of media organizations, Russian media organizations, are being banned from EU airwaves. But the big one is the complete ban on the import of Russian oil between now and the end of the year. And no mention specifically of gas, of course. The big questions, some of the questions being asked in the European Parliament today is how might Russia respond? Because, of course, we do import a lot of oil from Russia, but the big one is the gas. And therefore, if Russia decides, for example, to disrupt the supply of gas to more EU countries, like we saw in Poland and Bulgaria, what could be the financial implications for the European Union? So a lot of questions like that. Also, lawmakers were asking the questions, do sanctions work? I mean, don't forget, we're talking about six rounds of sanctions now, but I mean, the EU has been applying sanctions on Russia since 2014. And many lawmakers are saying that the sanctions don't work, that sanctions do not work because, you know, the EU is not the case that it's the only show in town for Russia. Russia can also do business with many other countries and so on. Therefore, the effectiveness of the sanctions is being called into question.
A top Russian investigator says the United States has been involved in Ukraine's bioweapons development program. Alexander Bastrikin says the analyses of obtained documents show representatives from the Pentagon and certain American firms have been involved in biological military activities in Ukraine. The Russian investigator says Washington has spent over $224 million since 2008 on such programs in Ukraine. He says the sum has been funneled into about 30 research centers run by Ukraine's defense, health, and agricultural ministries. Russia has long accused Ukraine of pursuing a U.S.-funded bioweapons program, that amid Washington's allegations that Moscow could launch a chemical attack on its western neighbor, a claim the Kremlin vehemently denies. Former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett says American and Israeli intelligence operatives have been engaged in bio labs in Ukraine since 2005.
We knew over a year ago about these bio labs and their experiments and the documents. We knew about the contractors. We knew about it originally starting in 2005 with the Defense Intelligence Agency that then created a 501c3 called the Global Viral Forecasting Institute with a Zionist Mossad operative named Nathaniel Wolf that then became Metabiota to make it more of a harmless name. And that Metabiota was being funded by Rosemont Fonseca, an investment firm that, ironically enough, Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, was the head of, along with Christopher Hines, who was the son of John Kerry, and Paul Pelosi Jr., the son of Nancy Pelosi. So this is a incestuous, corrupt, criminal racketeering operation that the West has been developing under Obama, under Biden, under, for the last 10 years, for the purposes of generating DNA biological chemical warfare to use against the Russians. That's why they've been collecting DNA samples from Slavic people. And of course, all of the documents and the evidence that General Igor Krylyov has found and commented on are all being exposed as revelations of a massive, really war crime, crime against humanity, because it's a violation of the Global Biological Chemical Weapons Agreement.
Russia and Israel are engaged in a row over Ukraine, the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman says. Israeli mercenaries are fighting alongside far-right anti-Moscow militants in Ukraine. Maria Zakharova said Israel is certainly aware of teaming up with the militants of the Azov regiment that Russia views as fascists and Nazis. On Tuesday, the Russian Foreign Ministry also accused Tel Aviv of backing what it called the neo-Nazi regime in Kiev. The war of words between the two sides started on Sunday after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Adolf Hitler had Jewish blood. His remarks drew fierce backlash in Israel. The regime has expressed solidarity with Ukraine over an ongoing Russian military operation there. Well, Yemen says its air defenses have shot down a Saudi spy drone flying over its airspace, according to Yemeni media. The drone was downed over the northwestern city of Hajja. Yemen's military has already brought down dozens of drones operated by the Saudi-led coalition in recent years. The incident comes amid a UN-brokered ceasefire agreement reached between the warring sides on April the 1st. Yemen says the coalition has on multiple occasions violated the truce by launching attacks. And China is taking more precautionary measures to contain the spread of COVID, with the capital Beijing shutting down dozens of subway stations and bus routes a day after the city recorded 51 infections. Authorities have gradually begun imposing restrictions on people fear they would face sudden stay-at-home orders. Housing compounds with reported infections have already been locked down, while tourist sites are tightening their rules and restaurants closing their doors. The central city of Zhengzhou has also ramped up controls, with residents in some areas remaining in their housing compounds. Officials say the measures are aimed at avoiding the fate of commercial hub Shanghai, where millions have been under strict lockdown for over a month. China has been battling its worst flare-up since the early days of the pandemic. North Korea has test-launched yet another ballistic missile amid worries on the Korean Peninsula over its nuclear program. The South Korean military says it detected the launch in the Sunan area of Pyongyang. It says a missile flew for about 470 kilometers toward the sea off the northeast coast. It comes a week after the North Korean leader vowed to accelerate the development of his country's nuclear arsenal, calling it a symbol of national power. Kim Jong-un also said that the North would not shy away from the preemptive use of nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces. This year alone, North Korea has fired 14 short- and long-range ballistic missiles. The country has doubled down on Kim's military modernization drive as well as missile tests, while ignoring the offer of talks from the United States. Our Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang joined us earlier with details about North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
What kind of missile this is, and those results of the investigation will come out later. However, just last week, the North paraded its Hwasong-17 Monster ICBM, which the U.S. missile defenses are helpless to stop. This missile can hit any point in the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. And so this is going to be what the focal point will be. The North had fired a missile, an ICBM missile, which it said was the Hwasong-17 last month, but the U.S. and South Korea claimed that this was not the Hwasong-17, but the Hwasong-15, an earlier version. And Pyongyang is eager to show that it is indeed firing off the Hwasong-17. Now, the Hwasong-17 is different from the Hwasong-15 because it has multiple warheads and decoys that can evade any U.S. missile defense systems.
New data leak shows a foreign client of the Israeli firm NSO selected over 200 Spanish mobile numbers to target them with its spyware Pegasus. Based on the leak, the selections were made by Morocco in 2019 and were part of more than 50,000 numbers to target by NSO clients worldwide. Just days ago, another revelation showed that Pegasus had infected the phones of Spain's prime minister and defense minister. The government has already launched an investigation. Madrid is also facing questions over how Pegasus was allegedly used to monitor Catalan leaders following a failed 2017 referendum there. Spain was then engaged in a tense diplomatic row with Morocco. Rabat denies spying on any foreign leaders using the Israeli malware. NSO has also rejected any link with the leak, but it's known for selling the spyware to government clients. The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses say Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nouri's family as they enter a court building. The footage shows that Swedish police failed to protect the family. Meanwhile, Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials didn't allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as a political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. Robert Carter was outside a Stockholm court where a group of MKO supporters was also demonstrating there. Our correspondent spoke with an eyewitness who had seen Hamid Nouri's family being harassed by the members of the terrorist group. Take a listen to what he had to say.
Fantastic. So you're living here in Sweden, an Iranian national, and just tell me, obviously you're not involved in what's going on here at the court, but as an eyewitness you've seen what the group to my right has been up to over the past couple of days, in specific harassment of the family of the accused who have been coming here on a daily basis to witness the proceedings and take part in the court case. Just tell us a little bit about what you've seen.
First of all, I'm really happy that I could find you to open my heart, actually, regarding to what's happening here. These people are known in all Iran history for the past 42 years. And unfortunately, those, I don't like to call them people, but those people standing there are the most hated group in Iran. They are a terrorist organization. They have been terroring, killing, torturing, bombing, and doing many crimes against Iranian civilians.
I think I wanted to ask you one more time exactly what you saw when you saw the harassment taking place. I think if you could describe that in a bit more detail. You saw them harassing the family of Nouri, is that right?
Yeah, the first time actually when I said it, there was a screaming. I was passing here to go to my job. I hear just in Persian language, it's a bunch of people screaming and saying really, really shameful and bad words toward the old woman, which I never have seen it in all my life. It didn't never exist in my world. So I was just shocked by what I'm hearing for what? Against a woman walking up to the stairs? all kind of those words, no point.
Administrative detention is an illegal practice that Israel uses extensively and routinely to hold Palestinians. The incarceration has no time limit, and the charges, if any, are never disclosed. The number of Palestinians held under this measure has hit a record high since 2016, but the international community is keeping silent on administrative detention, as it does with the other apartheid practices of the Israeli regime. And this is seen as a green light for Israel to continue its illegal occupation and violation of Palestinians' rights.
An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court. The detainees are usually held for renewable six-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic. What does piety mean? It means taking complete care of oneself. Piety, which is commonly defined as fear of God, means this. Fear of God has such a meaning. It means taking care not to take action against God's commands. This is piety. In such cases, when the Quran says, "But if you are constant and do right," there is a specific quality which is piety against the enemy. This means watching over the enemy and his moves, watching our own moves against him, being careful about his maneuvers and activities and about our response which might originate from negligence. Piety means this. The commander of the faithful says, the warrior should be wakeful because if he sleeps, the enemy does not sleep. This is in Nahjul Balagha, the Peak of the Eloquence, letter 62. This means being awake and remaining focused. In this era, piety means this. It contains the same general meaning of piety, but here it shows itself by watching over the enemy. This holds true in all areas.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In diplomacy, economy, security, piety is necessary. It is necessary in all these areas. In various matters, piety is necessary in line with the requirements of that matter. We must ask God for his help and take complete care of things. This was about God's command. Our experience shows the same thing, too. Once, we used to read these Quranic ayahs and verses, and the only experience we had was history, and we used to cite the early Islamic era as an experience. But today, this is not the case anymore. Today, we ourselves have experienced these matters. We ourselves have experienced in different arenas that if we show patience and piety, we will be victorious. The day when the war broke out, I am speaking about the sacred defense era, many of us would think that the war would last a week, 10 or 20 days, but it lasted 8 years. From the first day, Imam Rahmatullah Alayhi was confident. He did not announce that we would win, but we did not see any anxiety in him. He would ask questions, wanted explanations, and ask for details in meetings with the presence of officials. He would ask about things and why such and such thing was done. But there was no sign of worry and anxiety in Imam's face and behavior. In other words, he felt assured that it would end well. And he stood firm. He stood firm on various matters.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Leading a congressional delegation, U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has paid a visit to Ukraine. Pelosi, who is the highest-ranking American leader to visit Ukraine since the start of the war, has reiterated Washington's support for Ukraine. During a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, she vowed that the U.S. would stand by Ukraine until the end of the war with Russia.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
The United States is in an explicit war to weaken Russia and to defeat Russia, to help Ukrainian government defeat Russia in Ukraine. And it's, you know, Zelensky is really is someone who isn't making the decisions here. He's not going to be allowed to make a deal unless the United States lets him, and unless the right-wing forces in Ukraine let him.
Zelensky, for his part, thanked the U.S. and its Congress for, in his own words, the powerful signal of support. Pelosi's visit comes as the U.S. and its allies are stepping up to provide long-term support to Ukraine as the fighting rages on. Later in a statement, Pelosi said Russian President Vladimir Putin's, quote, diabolic invasion had taken a devastating human toll on Ukrainians. She also pledged imminent additional American support for Ukraine. The U.S. has already committed $4.3 billion to Kyiv in military support since 2021. Now, in a major increase of such funding, U.S. President Joe Biden has called on Congress to provide another $33 billion in emergency funding for Ukraine, including $20 billion for military aid. Moscow has warned that the aid would only fuel the conflict. Also, last week, responding to pleas from Zelensky, a group of 40 nations gathered by the U.S. and Germany agreed to streamline and expedite the delivery of weapons to Ukraine. Western nations have imposed broad economic sanctions on Russia and have been shipping increasing quantities of weapons to confront Russian forces. The Western intervention could lead to Russia's military response and raise the risk of confrontation between Russia and NATO, as well as a nuclear conflict. Some experts believe Washington's war aims had broadened from helping Ukraine to defend itself to damaging Russia itself. This notion supports the Russian narrative that Moscow's actions in Ukraine are to defend itself against NATO. U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed a $33 billion package for arming and supporting Ukraine. He also outlined proposed new laws to transfer the frozen assets of Russia's elite to Ukraine. The proposal is part of U.S. policies to ratchet up economic pressure on Russia over the Ukraine war. On the other hand, Moscow has warned that it may seize the Russian-based assets of countries it considers hostile. The Speaker of Russia's lower house of parliament says the proceeds from the sale of these assets will be used for the country's development. Vyacheslav Volodin accused some countries of violating international law and resorting to pure theft. He particularly named Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, and even the United States. Volodin said the U.S. has set a dangerous precedent that could backfire. Meanwhile, Russia's defense ministry said on Sunday it had carried out a missile strike on a military airfield near the port city of Odessa, destroying a runway and a hangar containing weapons and ammunition supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. and European countries. That's after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned that any shipment of weapons by NATO into Ukraine would be a legitimate target for Russia. Lavrov had also blamed Ukraine for the current impasse in the peace talks, accusing Kyiv of a desire to play games. He said the negotiations could have produced results if it was not for the interference of the United States and Britain.
Are they willing to go all in a war against Russia here? They are going to have to put massive amounts of weaponry in. And the Russians are going to try to prevent that. So we are in a very dangerous place where there's a significant possibility of not only a regional but a world war.
Moscow has also blasted the West for encouraging Ukraine to strike Russia. That's after UK Defense Minister Ben Wallace said Ukraine has the right to strike military targets inside Russia. Meanwhile, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said earlier that any country deemed to be interfering in Ukraine would meet a lightning-fast response using weapons.
Thank you.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has once again stated that Pyongyang could preemptively use its nuclear weapons if threatened. In a meeting with the top military brass, Kim expressed a firm will to continue developing his nuclear-armed military so that it could preemptively and thoroughly contain and frustrate all dangerous attempts and threatening moves, including ever-escalating nuclear threats from hostile forces if necessary. His comments come as he praised his top military officials over the staging of a massive military parade in the capital Pyongyang last Monday. The parade marked the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Korean People's Revolutionary Army. It also featured the country's latest intercontinental ballistic missiles. On that occasion, too, Kim vowed to accelerate the development of North Korea's nuclear arsenal.
The basic mission of our nuclear force is to deter war, but our nuclear weapons cannot be bound to only one mission. If any force attempts to usurp the fundamental interests of our country, our nuclear force will have no choice but to carry out its second mission unexpectedly.
The country has progressed its nuclear and missile program despite international pressure over the past years. North Korea has conducted 13 rounds of weapons launches in 2022 alone, including its first full-range test of an intercontinental ballistic missile since 2017. In addition, satellite imagery has shown signs of activity at a nuclear testing site. Pyongyang has been reeling under crippling international sanctions over its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile development activities, which it maintains are designed to deter potential aggression by the US and its allies, including South Korea, who frequently hold joint military drills and weapon tests on the Korean Peninsula. Meanwhile, South Korea says Pyongyang's military tests escalate tensions and worsen ties between the two neighbors, but Pyongyang says its tests are in response to mounting tensions on the Korean Peninsula, triggered by joint military exercises between Seoul and Washington. The United States also stations about 28,500 troops in the south. The latest developments come as South Korea prepares for an incoming president, Yoon Suk-yeol, who takes a more hawkish approach to Pyongyang and has not ruled out a preemptive strike if necessary, vowing to strengthen the South's defense in conjunction with the alliance with the United States. Nuclear negotiations between Washington and Pyongyang have been stalled since 2019 because of disagreements over a potential easing of U.S.-led sanctions in exchange for North Korean disarmament steps. Former U.S. President Donald Trump met with the North's leader three times, but he refused to meet Pyongyang's demand for the removal of some sanctions in return for major North Korean measures toward demilitarization. Meanwhile, the current administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has imposed sanctions on dozens of North Korean people and entities. Surely, that's not a sign of goodwill to resolve differences. There is also the issue of South Korea. The new president is pro-U.S., adding to the friction between the two Koreas. Meanwhile, Kim has stuck to his goal of simultaneously developing nuclear weapons and the country's dismal economy in the face of sanctions, and has shown no willingness to fully surrender a nuclear arsenal he sees as his biggest guarantee of survival.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea, also known as North Korea, has always, from day one of its founding as a sovereign nation and republic, a people's republic, has always developed its military capabilities in defense against U.S. imperialism, against European imperialism.
Pyongyang has time and again stressed that the primary role of possessing nukes was to discourage threats against the country. After all, it makes sense, particularly when we look at the example of Ukraine. Even the Ukrainian ambassador to Tehran confessed that his country should have developed its military capabilities instead of relying on guarantees from foreign forces such as NATO.
A recent report by the Council on American-Islamic Relations shows anti-Muslim hate crimes have been on the rise in the United States over the past year. In a news conference following the publication of the report, head of the council, Nihad Awad, described Islamophobia in the United States as deep and systematic.
Islamophobia has become mainstream in America. It made its way into the government institutions and public sphere through laws, policies, political rhetoric, and other manifestations.
Yeah, Islamophobia has been a huge phenomenon in the U.S. since 2001, when the September 11th false flag operation was deliberately used by enemies of Islam to trigger this tidal wave of hatred of Muslims and Islam that led to a series of wars that killed millions of people.
The report shows that the council received over 6,700 complaints nationwide last year, the highest the organization has recorded in 27 years, which represented a 9% increase since the year before. They involved a range of issues, including immigration, travel discrimination, law enforcement, government overreach, hate and bias, custody rights, school incidents, and free speech. Over 2,800 of the incidents were reportedly travel-related. The report cites last year's tensions in Afghanistan and the ensuing immigration crisis as the reason for such a large figure. The report also cites a 28% increase in complaints of hate and bias incidents, including the forcible removal of hijabs, harassment, vandalism, physical assault, and so on. The Council on the American-Islamic Relations describes what it calls the Islamophobia Network as a decentralized group of actors, organizations, and individuals that share extreme anti-Muslim ideologies who lobby to influence government policy and public opinion about Islam. They include politicians, think tanks, scholars, religious groups, and activists that paint a distorted face of Islam and Muslims for political and financial gain. Listed among the top financiers of the Islamophobia Network, according to the council, are right-wing evangelical groups and pro-Israel organizations, most of whom are members of the Republican Party.
Islamophobia has not only been profitable for Zionists and the military-industrial complex, politicians, but also for these con artists who've created an Islamophobia industry that sells all kinds of books and drums up contributions, often at churches, and gets funded by these billionaire, mostly Zionists.
Back in December, the U.S. House voted for legislation to counter Islamophobia globally. The lawmakers voted along party lines, with the Democrats edging only 7 votes over the 212 that the Republicans had cast. It followed U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert's Islamophobic comments against Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, one of the handful Muslim lawmakers in the U.S., earlier that month.
The Islamophobia industry comes up with all sorts of nonsense and sort of distorted, cherry-picked items from the religious tradition mixed in with all sorts of lies and kinds of grotesque accusations. And then it spams this out in mass, and so it's really polluting the entire infosphere.
The United Nations has called for the adoption of a global strategy that includes defeating all forms of violent ideologies. The question is how to execute such a strategy to make it appealing to all nations and people.
The conflict in Ukraine has raised the prospects of an all-out confrontation between nuclear-armed states. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has warned about a real danger of World War III breaking out. In his comments to Russian media outlets, Lavrov added that given the current tensions between Russia and the West, the danger of a World War III was, quote, real. Lavrov also criticized Ukraine's approach to the talks and said if negotiations do not move in a reciprocal way, the negotiation process will be hampered. Lavrov also accused NATO of engaging in a war with Russia through a proxy.
I think that the U.S. and their allies have been pushing the world towards a sort of World War III or even a new Cold War mentality for months and even years now, with the kind of propaganda and various official lines that the United States and their closest allies like Great Britain, France, and Germany have been pushing against Russia.
Meanwhile, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba has criticized his Russian counterpart for warning of a real danger of World War III, saying Lavrov's comments indicated that, quote, Moscow senses defeat. Lavrov's warning came after the U.S. pledged more aid to Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken paid a top-secret visit to Kyiv on Sunday and promised to supply more arms to Ukraine.
And I think that the NATO encroachment and the furthering of NATO interests throughout Europe as they get closer and closer to Russia's borders justifies some reaction from Russia. And the United States is going to continue pushing in their interest, which is only going to get us closer to World War III.
Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in the Kremlin on Tuesday for talks revolving around the Ukrainian crisis. Putin said Moscow's move to recognize the breakaway republics of Donetsk and Luhansk was based on the Kosovo precedent set up by a UN-backed court. Following the meeting, the UN said Russian President agreed in principle to UN involvement in evacuations of civilians from Azovstal steel plant. Meanwhile, dozens of U.S. allies met in Germany to bolster Ukraine's military. Traditionally neutral countries of Sweden and Finland are also taking part in the meeting. The conference secured pledges from allies to sustain aid to Ukraine's military throughout this next phase of the war and beyond. The meeting saw a major pledge from Germany, which said it would deliver tanks to Ukraine in a radical switch in policy on the supply of military equipment to the country. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin added, the conference would transform into a monthly contact group on Ukraine's self-defense. According to a Pentagon official, at least 18 of the 19 towed artillery pieces Washington promised in the past 2 weeks have already been delivered to Ukrainian forces, and more are being rushed this week. In addition, Washington is supplying nearly 200,000 rounds of howitzer ammunition and is arranging for ammunition supplies for the Russian-made artillery that Ukrainian forces currently operate. France is sending its ultra-advanced Caesar mobile howitzer, and the Czech Republic is delivering its older self-propelled howitzers. Canada, too, is sending howitzers and advanced guided Excalibur shells that can travel more than 40 kilometers and deliver munitions precisely on target. The UK, on the other side, said it will send Stormer armored vehicles carrying anti-missile launchers to Kyiv. British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the country is also looking to provide Ukraine with long-range artillery and ammunition, as well as anti-ship missiles.
So, I believe there is a limit to how far these countries will allow the United States to use them. And I think that when it comes to threats of nuclear war or the risk of a, you know, all-out World War III with Russia, I do think that we're going to see states in Europe start to stand up to that U.S. imperialism and try and go against them, maybe even allying with Russia themselves.
The European Commission insists that arming Ukraine is not about prolonging the conflict. However, a growing number of civil society organizations and lawmakers in the European countries believe the West should be prioritizing peace talks over arms delivery. Moscow has warned Western countries of the unpredictable consequences for arming Ukraine. Russia says it views Western military supplies to Ukraine as legitimate targets.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kHz and in southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyara of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام الحمية رأس الدواء والمعدة بيت الداء عود بدنا ما تعود.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, diet control is the fountainhead of remedies and the stomach is the house of all ailments. So condition your body while it can be conditioned.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We find in the beautiful conversations of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam, that he talks to his companions and his friends about a whole host of different things. We do find that one of the things that Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam talks about in one of his conversations deals with being disobedient to our parents. Now, in this conversation with one of his companions, Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam says that the Messenger of Allah has said, when talking about disobedience to parents, the Holy Messenger of Allah has said, be obedient to your parents and restrict yourself to the garden. Be disobedient and rude with your parents and restrict yourself to the fire. Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam here very beautifully tells us this tradition from the Messenger of Allah. Of course, as the tradition goes, the first of us is Muhammad, the last of us is Muhammad, and the middle of us is Muhammad, meaning that all of the divinely appointed Imams, they speak the words and the messages of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And so here we find that being obedient to our parents will take us towards the garden, the paradise, the heaven. But on the other hand, being disobedient and rude with our parents will lead us towards the fires of hell. In this day and age, and perhaps in even previous ages and eras, we find that sometimes it is quite difficult for a youth to be obedient to their parents. Now, of course, we must try our best to remain silent in front of our parents, and we must try to understand the commands that our parents give us. Because surely a loving and righteous and noble parent only wants good for their children. And so in reality, when we obey our righteous, good, and honorable parents, then we are truly doing something which is for our own benefit. And if we are disobeying the commandments of our righteous and noble parents, then of course that is going to lead us towards trouble. And so being obedient to our parents is not only good for this world, but also for the hereafter. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Mansur Dawaniqi summoned the Imam with the intention of killing him. When Imam entered Baghdad, he himself went forward and welcomed the Imam and mentioned that I had a dream of Amir al-Mu'mineen, of Ali ibn Abi Talib. And in this dream, I saw that he was reciting a verse of the Quran. And then right after that, Mansur inquires the 6th, 7th Imam. He says that, are you going to revolt against me? Then Imam replied that, I have no such intention of revolting against you. The Khulafa were always in fear of losing their power because their Khilafat was not on the hearts of people. The Khilafat of the Masumeen, the Khilafat of the Imams were on the heart of the people. They governed the heart. They were the rulers of the heart. Because of their sifat, because of their qualities, because of their behavior, because of their akhlaq, how they were, because of their knowledge. As we all know, that the scholars who lived during the lifetime of the 7th Imam, they praised the Imam. He was known as Salih. Another title of the Imam, of the seventh Imam, is Salih, the righteous one. He was profoundly known for his spirituality, for his generosity, for his knowledge, for his enduring patience.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Rules of Engagement Part 2
Berlin, Germany. From here, we are going to start looking at the occupation of Palestine. This is an unusual look through the eyes of Israeli soldiers that broke their silence. They will tell about the crimes they committed on behalf of the Zionist regime.
Now 4 million people are in control of the Palestinian society, and we as soldiers that were sent to the army in Israel at the age of 18, 19, you go to the army, it's a mandatory service. About 5-6 months I served in Hebron, the second largest Palestinian city in the West Bank. 800 settlers that live inside of a Palestinian city. For those 800 people, there are about 500-600 security forces to protect them. This exhibition, about 60 pictures all taken by soldiers, and they took those pictures during their military service for a memory for themselves. When your mission is to do a curfew or detain people and you succeed in this mission, you wanna document. This is like a trophy for you. It's a sick trophy, and these guys, no doubt, lost every kind of limit there is. And if that's not enough, you see this soldier here, the officer, he wanted the trophy only for himself. So he wanted to do a Photoshop picture. It's not a genuine picture, this is not real. It's copied here. I did occupation. I controlled people's lives. I decided if someone can or cannot go to school today. This picture is a good example. A soldier randomly checking a Palestinian in the street. The middle of the day, he hasn't done anything, he's not suspected, checks him. This was probably the most regular view in Hebron for us. Detained Palestinians. Hundreds of them. So what does it mean to detain a person? See the soldiers on the back? This was a good time to relax, to have a break, smoke a cigarette, talk with your friend, watch TV, have a lunch maybe. Without noticing again, these people that you detain, start looking at them as people. They are just detained Palestinians. Blindfolded, always. We see here are confiscated keys, Palestinian keys. We control not only people's cars, we control people's keys, homes and shops and apartments, whatever you can imagine. You can come a bit closer, I want to show you this picture. If you would look carefully, Palestinian kids play soldiers. See, they're checking each other. These are supposed to be the guns. And in a way, I'm saying it in a very sad way, because these children imitate their life. This is not